Good evening, everyone. Hello and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma on Cure Talks' 84th episode. March is Myeloma Awareness Month, and we are having an extended broadcast today. We will first hear from about allogeneic transplants for myeloma treatment, and then have the opportunity to listen to about a new myeloma therapy under research. My co-host for the talk is myeloma advocate Pat Killingsworth, and supporting Pat is our esteemed myeloma panel, consisting of advocates Gary Peterson, Jack Aiello, and Cynthia Schmulewski. We are truly excited to have amongst us a very distinguished expert, Dr. William Bensinger. Dr. Bensinger is director of the Autologous Marrow Transplant Program at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, a member in the Clinical Research Division at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and a professor of medicine at the University of Washington. Dr. Bensinger, welcome to Cure Talks.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We will be addressing questions sent in via email towards the end of the discussion. If you have a question for our expert, you can let us know by pressing 1 on your keypad. With that, now it's over to Pat. Pat, you're on air.
Hello, Doctor. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Now, I understand I checked your title, and I see that you focus primarily on autologous stem cell transplants, and yet almost all the questions we have this evening are allogeneic. But I'm guessing that's not an issue.
So I'm the director of the autologous autologous stem cell transplant program at the Hutchinson Center and the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, but that doesn't prevent me from doing studies and investigating allogeneic transplant treatments for whatever disease is appropriate, but in this case, multiple myeloma.
Of course, and that's good, and I believe we met at ASH this year, didn't we, in San Francisco?
I believe we did, yes.
Yeah, it was wonderful for you to take the time to speak with me. And so I'd like to start out with a question about auto transplants before we move into the donor realm here. Over the years, I've heard from a number of patients that had transplants, I hate to use the word failed, but have transplants that didn't work well or really didn't help much at all. And now I find myself, and actually I was one of those people 3 or 4 years ago, and now I find myself facing a difficult situation where I'm running out of options, and a doctor that I respect, a specialist I respect, has recommended that I transplant again. And I wondered if I could get your thoughts on, for me and so many others, if you were going to transplant again, do you do something different? If melphalan doesn't really do the trick, do you add things to maybe try to help the effectiveness on a second try?
So to start with, as I'm sure you're aware, multiple myeloma is a very heterogeneous disease, and there's a number of different subtypes that have more or less aggressive features. What that means is that patients as individuals will differ with respect to their response to any form of treatment, and autologous transplant is no different. And so there are patients who derive tremendous benefit from an auto transplant, just as there are patients who won't respond or derive little or no benefit. The way we measure the benefits is to try to include a large enough series of patients on any studies to see if overall there is benefit for this. Now, in terms of a prior transplant that in which a patient has relapsed, we often try to judge the length of the initial remission after transplant as a gauge to whether we think a second transplant will benefit. Generally speaking, patients that have a disease-free interval of about 2 years, we think it's worthwhile to consider a second transplant. In patients whose remission lasts a year or less, we do not generally think a second transplant is likely to provide much benefit. There are some studies that have attempted to improve on single-agent melphalan. To date, there is no data to suggest that any one regimen or any different regimen is better than single-agent melphalan. Having said that, there are some groups that will use a regimen commonly known as BEAM, which is a four-drug regimen that includes melphalan for a second transplant. Other groups have added in one or more of the proteasome inhibitors, such as bortezomib or carfilzomib, to a melphalan-containing regimen. But there really isn't any data to say definitively that that's going to produce better results.
I appreciate that. So just to follow up, so maybe there isn't necessarily a direct correlation between, well, let me give you an example. So if I had a transplant that wasn't successful, I guess in my mind I was thinking, well, that means down the road, melphalan prednisone wouldn't be a successful therapy for me, for example. But it sounds like you're saying maybe those two things aren't necessarily connected.
Well, they're not. But again, when you say a transplant is not successful, you have to define what you mean by that. If a person goes 3 years and then relapses, well, ultimately that transplant was not successful. But the fact that they went 3 years in remission is, in fact, a measure of success.
Sure. Oh, I would call that successful. No, when I say not successful, that means they went in with a 0.4 M spike and they came out with a 0.4 M spike. Or in my case, I went in with a 0.1 and I came out with a 0.5. So, to me, I guess a year or 2 years or 3 years, I suppose you have to define what success is. The median is around 2 years, isn't it? I just meant a lot of patients get what seems to be very little or no benefit out of the transplant process. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know what to tell you on that.
Sure, okay, but what I'm saying I'm not incorrect in what I'm saying, right? I mean, that's all I'm asking. I don't want to be passing along incorrect information. So, okay. Great, that was helpful. And then I have an allo question to kick us off, and that's when I look at mortality rates for donor transplants, for allogeneic transplants, it always seems that they're higher for multiple myeloma patients. And I've asked a number of specialists about that, and I get several different answers, but I also get a lot of shoulder shrugs and honest, I'm not sure why that is. But why does the mortality rate tend to be higher among multiple myeloma patients?
So patients with multiple myeloma have, by virtue of their disease, an underlying immunodeficiency. They typically have lower or abnormally low levels of antibodies in their blood. Antibodies are one of our immune systems that protect us from infection. As a result of that, they tend to be more prone to develop opportunistic infections after an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And certainly historically, the mortality after high-dose therapy and allogeneic stem cell transplant was extraordinarily high, in the 30 to 50% range, and high enough that many of us abandoned that strategy a number of years ago because we felt the mortality was too high. Now, since that time, there have been a lot of improvements in supportive care for patients with myeloma, and this has reduced the mortality of ablative transplants down to the 20% range. That's still very high. Another strategy is to use the so-called non-ablative or reduced intensity transplants. These are much lower doses of drugs designed not so much to attack the myeloma, but to prevent rejection of the donor graft, and so allows the donor graft to be to take over and develop its own immunity within the patient. This type of strategy is much less toxic to patients and associated with a considerably lower mortality in the range of 10 to 15%. This appears to be in line with what we see with the majority of other hematologic malignancies that receive similar conditioning. So things have improved quite a bit, but you know, there is still a higher mortality with allogeneic transplants compared to an autologous transplant, where the mortality there is typically only 1 to 2%.
Sure. That's a great answer, Doctor. Thank you very much. And I believe our next questioner, you may even have met him at ASH. He was with me, Gary Peterson. And Gary, are you with us?
Sure am. Hi, Pat. Can you hear me?
How you doing?
Yes. Doctor, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, I looked at, you know, the Be the Match, I think is what it is, and they have some great information on it. And I got to tell you this, is one of the things is that the Seattle Care Alliance is one of the very few who publish their survival data. And I've got to congratulate you for that. And obviously that's one of the reasons, because you track your survival and because you do the analytics behind it, that you guys do a better job than most at survival. I looked at the eight of the largest centers, and the average one-year survival was 67%, or one in three patients do not make it 1 year. However, your Seattle Care Alliance has an 83% one-year survival rate. What are you doing differently that others that do not, with allos, that others do not do? And you have, I believe it is 45, in the last 3 years, you've done 45 allo transplants on myeloma patients, which doesn't seem to be a lot. But that happens to be the most of any single institution in the United States. So what are you doing differently?
Well, it's hard for me to put a handle on it. We certainly have the longest experience with allogeneic transplants of any center in the country, if not the world. So we've been doing allogeneic transplants for 30-plus years. And what we've tried to do over the years is learn from our results and our experiences, good and bad. And we're very regimented about supportive care, proper antibiotic use, use of other agents to prevent infections such as IV immunoglobulin. We've implemented some strategies that we think reduce some types of graft versus host disease. And all of these things are probably incremental in terms of their benefits on patients. But as an aggregate, I think all of these strategies have resulted in a reduction in the transplant-associated mortality with our allograft patients.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor. I appreciate that. And as a matter of fact, not that long ago, as I recall, you know, you were on, I think, another one of the presentations, or I think it was Managing Myeloma. And one of the things that you said was that it's a myeloma is just a very, a disease, an orphan disease. And as a result, people don't get to see that many of them. And you were saying that it's so important that you get somebody who knows about this disease and has had hundreds of patients, because that's the only way that you're going to get adequate care. And I totally agree with you, and I was wondering what your thoughts were with regard to that.
Yeah, so I do think that getting the advice and a second opinion of a specialist at a center that sees more than a handful of these patients is extremely important. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to move and leave where you live and go live in the city where this specialist resides. But you can basically have your doctor partner with a specialist, have your physician have you seen by a specialty group wherever that center is, and work with them in terms of designing a particular treatment program, making decisions about when transplant is appropriate, making decisions about maintenance therapy, and really engage that specialist to help manage your disease. I think that's the winning strategy if you're a patient with myeloma, and you don't have to live, you know, at a big major center to benefit from that.
Well, thank you, Doctor. And Pat, if you want to go on to others, I got a couple more questions, but I'll ask them later. And Doctor, thank you. It's the same strategy that Danny Parker uses. He uses Dr. Wolf in I think it's in San Francisco, or
yep,
in California anyway.
Yep.
And
yep,
he uses Dr. Wolf in his. And he lives in Florida. And he lives in Florida. So talk about exactly what you just talked about. That's, I guess, as extreme as you can get.
Yep.
Thanks, Gary. Cindy, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me, Pat?
Yeah, let's get a woman's perspective here. What do you think?
Okay.
Fire away.
I think that allo transplant seems scary whenever anyone brings that up to me. I guess because I've heard that high mortality rates, and I was just wondering if there are certain types of pre-testing that are recommended before you would be even considered to undergo an allo transplant to make sure that your body is in good enough shape to handle what's being thrown at you. So are there certain testing that you do ahead of time?
So you're
pulmonary,
I mean,
testing? And,
yeah,
you know, things like that.
So I agree with you that allogeneic transplants are scary. They do have the potential to have a higher risk of dying from the treatment. As a result of that, we typically only offer allogeneic transplants to patients who have certain high-risk features of their disease that predict that they will do poorly with just the drugs that are available today with or without an autologous stem cell transplant. So we know, for example, that patients who have a 17p deletion or a 414 deletion or have extra copies of chromosome 1Q have a more aggressive disease. And the studies looking at the outcomes of these patients after induction treatment and autologous transplant suggest that these patients have a much shorter length of remission and a poorer overall survival. These are the kinds of patients that we generally recommend to consider an allogeneic transplant. The idea of an allogeneic transplant is you're basically relying on the immune system from the new donor. It's actually the oldest form of immunotherapy. So it's the first treatment that was developed involving the a way to reverse the deficiencies in the immune system that allow the myeloma to grow in the first place. And it is the treatment that is associated with the longest survival. I have a particular patient I'm fond of who we transplanted more than 25 years ago from her brother, and she is alive and doing well and is free of disease. So it is associated in some patients with long-term disease control, and I would dare say after 25 years, a cure. Now, going into this transplant, we do have to make sure that the patient has a suitable donor, and so it's important to do tissue typing between the patient and the donor. This is accomplished by a simple blood test or even a swab of the cheek area where you can get some cells for DNA analysis. This can be used to perform what we call HLA typing, which are antigens that are part of the histocompatibility complex, and they determine graft rejection, graft versus host disease. What you want is a fully matched donor, ideally. Once you've found a donor, the patient it needs to be evaluated not only for their disease status, but to make sure that they're healthy in other ways. They have to have reasonably normal heart and lung and kidney function, and so they undergo testing to make sure that they don't have any major medical problems that might interfere with their therapy. But once those things have been done, if everything looks okay, patients can move forward with a donor transplant.
Okay, that sounds... Now, would you recommend for that patient, maybe a young patient who has those high-risk characteristics, to go like right after induction into an allogeneic transplant, or would you want to see how they respond to an autologous transplant first?
Well, generally we know if a patient has high-risk features, they're going to have a relatively short remission with an autologous transplant. Each time the disease comes back, it gets a little bit harder to treat. And this is especially true if the patient has high-risk cytogenetic features. The disease tends to come back more aggressively with each subsequent relapse. And so if it's appropriate for that particular patient, we think the best time to consider doing the allogeneic transplant is as part of their initial therapy, the induction, and perhaps, depending on the regimen, perhaps an auto transplant first to try to get rid of as much of the disease as possible prior to going into the allograft.
Okay. Now, I've heard various places that when you're going into an allogeneic transplant, it's necessary that you're almost in a very good partial remission or a complete remission. Is that true, that you need to have almost all your disease taken away by another method before you go into the transplant?
So here's something to keep in mind. If you're in a remission, and we define a remission as no monoclonal protein that's measurable in the blood or the urine, no abnormal cells in the bone marrow, and by all testing that we can do, that patient is in remission. What you need to remember, though, is that the typical patient who's in remission can have between 100 million and a billion residual cancer cells in their body, but they're diluted among trillions of other cells. And so they have still a significant disease burden left behind, but you can't detect it because it's below the limits of our testing to do that. At that time, we think it's the best time to consider doing a donor transplant. There, this the transplant from a donor relies on this immune effect. We call it a graft versus myeloma effect. If you have a large amount of residual disease, however, it becomes more difficult for the graft, which has to grow and develop in the patient to a reasonable size to basically be effective. It becomes much harder for that graft to deal with a larger volume of tumor rather than a patient who's in remission. So remission, keep in mind, is generally associated with still a significant disease burden. It's just that we're unable to detect it at that level.
Okay. And one last question before I go on. You were talking earlier about matching to get a match donor and the like perfect match is the best thing. What about the person who really can't find a match related or through one of the Be the Match banks? Have there been cord blood allogeneic transplants for myeloma patients?
They have been done, but they're very rare. We've only done a handful of the cord blood transplants. Part of the problem with cord blood transplants is that the cell dose in a cord blood is rather limited. And for a large adult, that lower cell dose may be insufficient to get a reliable graft. The other area where there seems to be some promise, and it's still in the early stages, is doing what are called haploidentical transplants. So these are transplants using a brother or sister who's not a complete match, but we've learned some technologies and techniques for markedly reducing the graft versus host disease by killing off the cells that lead to graft versus host disease at an early stage after the transplant. We still haven't done very many of them, but there are beginning to be some greater experiences with these haploidentical transplants, and I think they're going to be promising in the future.
That sounds exciting. Okay, thanks, Doc. And Pat, why don't you go on to Jack?
Thanks, Cindy. Jack, are you with us from California?
I am, and I look forward to seeing Dr. Bensinger at the IMF seminar this weekend.
I'm heading down there tomorrow in about roughly 24 hours.
Uh-huh. I will see you there.
Awesome. Go ahead, sir.
I have a few questions. I'll follow up on Cynthia's. Is there definitely a correlation between successful allos for myeloma patients and the donor stem cell sources, where sources can be a matched sibling, a matched unrelated donor called a MUD? Do you prefer matched sibling over a MUD?
So our preference is always a matched sibling. Having said that, there are not huge differences between a matched unrelated donor. Typically what we see is with a matched unrelated donor, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 10% greater incidence of graft versus host disease. However, this only has a minor effect on overall survival, so that using a matched unrelated donor produces about the same outcomes as using a matched related donor. You get a little more graft versus host disease, but you probably get a little bit better anti-myeloma effect because of that. And they sort of balance each other out.
Along those same lines, would you prefer a matched unrelated donor to the haploidentical sibling that you mentioned?
At the present time, I would. But I think that there's starting to be some promising work being done with the haploidentical donors. And I think in a few years, my opinion could change.
Is there any correlation of successful allo with the patient donor gender? I've actually heard that it's better for a male to donate to a female, or is there any such thing as that, for example?
Yeah, so the the male donors are associated with less graft versus host disease. And the reason for that is that the majority of the female donors undergo some degree of sensitization during pregnancy. And so their T cells are more alloreactive because of prior pregnancies. As a result of that, female donors are associated with, again, similar to the unrelated donors, a somewhat greater risk of graft versus host disease, but at the same time, a lower risk of relapse. So it's kind of similar when you parse that out between male and female donors. You get a similar result to the difference between matched-related and matched-unrelated.
So it's not an opposite sex attract. It's more the preference for male donors in general, whether it's male-to-male or male.
Mainly because of this issue of sensitization.
Yeah, okay. Should allotransplants patients get re-immunized with their childhood vaccines, or do they already get these from the donor transplant?
At 1 year, what we do is we test patients for a variety of the typical pathogens that we immunize for and look for antibody development. If they're deficient in any of these, we re-immunize them.
Is that what you do for auto as well?
Yes, but at auto, we do it at 6 months.
Okay, got it. And then finally, when doing an allo, how do you decide between the reduced intensity or mini technique or non-myeloablative, whatever you want to call it, versus the full or myeloablative technique?
Yeah, that's a complicated question, but it certainly depends in part on the disease status of the patient. So if you have a patient who's in a good remission, who's, say, undergone a recent autologous transplant and has recovered and has minimal disease, generally you're going to go with a reduced intensity regimen. If you have a patient who's got pretty resistant disease, who's failed one or more therapies, may have failed an autologous transplant, and you're not able to get them to this minimal residual disease state, you're generally going to be looking at a more intensive regimen, tending to be more full-dose myeloablative. There are also some strategies that we're looking at to hopefully give the best of both worlds. So, for example, we've taken the backbone of the reduced intensity transplant and added into that a radioisotope using an antibody that targets the bone marrow, the lymph nodes, the spleen. And the idea is to provide radiation to the major sites where the myeloma tends to hang out, and thereby provide a way to control the disease. But at the same time, using these guided radioisotopes, we avoid the lungs and the kidneys and the liver, which are major targets for toxicity with external radiation. So the idea is to provide this targeted radiation as a way to provide what is essentially a more intensive regimen, but yet it's going to be safer for the patient.
No longer giving TBI before the allo, huh?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much. I look forward to talking with you again this weekend.
All right. Look forward to seeing you.
Thanks, Jack. Thank you, Doctor. So, Priya, this is a wonderful opportunity. Normally, it's hard to get the panelists to stop asking questions, and we run out of an hour, so it looks like we've got some time to take for the doctor to take questions that people have emailed in or callers on the line. Do you want to take it from here?
Thank you so much, Pat. We have a long list of questions which have been sent in via email, and while we get going on them, listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Bensinger, you would like to ask live, please press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you live to ask your question. Yes, I think we have one person. Maybe we should just begin with that. Person calling in from 703-237-9690. Please ask your question. Person calling in from 237-9690, you are live. Please ask your question. Okay, maybe we should just start with our list of questions. Dr. Benson, first question is there an age limit for a patient who's doing well after relapse on Velcade maintenance to go on to an allo?
To go on to an allogeneic transplant?
Yep.
Is that the question?
Yes, that's the question.
It's not so much a chronologic age as a biologic age. As a generality, we tend to use a rough age of around 70 in terms of decision making about whether to proceed to an allogeneic transplant or not. Having said that, there are patients who are in their low 70s who are quite robust, and their chronologic age of 72 is much higher than their I would consider their biologic age. They may be more like a 60-year-old person. These are patients that on an individual basis we would certainly consider for an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And then the other side of that is, of course, there are patients who may be in their 50s but have bad chronic obstructive lung disease or bad heart disease. And these are patients that are much more likely to develop complications from any type of transplant, perhaps even an autologous transplant. And they're patients that we're generally going to discourage from moving forward with these types of treatments.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is, do you need to be in complete remission to do a full allogeneic transplant as part of a first-line therapy?
You don't need to be in a first remission to do it. However, the data that have looked at outcomes suggest that patients who are in first remission have longer lengths of remission and a higher chance of long-term survival and the potential for cure. So while you can do a transplant in patients who are not in a complete remission, we like in general to have patients in that condition prior to transplant because we know that they will have a better outcome.
Thank you, Doctor. The next is, what is the significance of a T-cell depletion relative to an allogeneic stem cell transplant?
So T-cell depletion is based on the idea that T-cells are the cells most responsible for cause of graft versus host disease, and that by depleting these T cells from the graft, you can reduce the chances of this complication. That is a strategy that was developed actually at our center almost 25 years ago. And we did a variety of transplants using various T cell depletion strategies. The problem is that there were quite a few complications from this. When you T-deplete the graft, there's a greater chance of graft rejection, that the graft will not take in the patient because these T-cells play an important role in establishment of the graft. In addition, while graft versus host disease could clearly be reduced, there was also a much higher incidence of relapse of the disease. And this is true of myeloma, but it was also true of the various leukemias that are transplanted as well. And as a result of that, our feeling was that pure T-cell depletion by itself was fraught with too many problems, and we abandoned this as a strategy at our center. Now, there are some groups that are looking at selective T-cell depletion. The term that's often used is graft engineering, where they try to deplete certain populations of T-cells that may be more responsible for graft versus host disease and yet would preserve the anti-leukemia or anti-myeloma effect of the graft. These are strategies that have been in the works for some time, but I have to say there isn't any definitive data about which T-cell subsets to get rid of and which way is the best way to go.
Thank you, Doctor. The next is, could you explain in layman terms what the graft versus tumor effect of the allogeneic transplant means and how this is different from the graft versus host effect?
Yes. So graft versus host disease results from, as I said earlier, T cells. These are T cells that are contained in the graft that will react to antigens present on certain tissues of the patient. These tissues tend to be confined to the gastrointestinal tract, the skin, the liver, and sometimes the lungs. So this causes these T cells to proliferate, and eventually, if there's significant graft versus host disease, to cause damage to these tissues. The graft versus tumor effect is a similar type of T cell reaction directed against the tumor cells. Now, as you probably know, is most of the tumors that arise in our body are derived from normal cells and normal tissues. So these cells will often contain many of the same target antigens that are present on normal tissues. Sometimes, if you're lucky enough, they'll contain unique targets that are only present on the tumor. But the goal is to exploit this graft versus tumor effect and avoid the graft versus host disease. As it turns out, when we do analyses of outcomes in patients who've had allogeneic transplants, the patients who have no graft versus host disease at all tend to do worse. And this is because they tend to have a higher rate of relapse. The patients who have severe graft versus host disease similarly do poorly because of the damage from their normal tissues. The patients who do the best are the ones who have a mild form of graft versus host disease that is easily treated and easily controlled. So the graft versus host reaction and the graft versus tumor effect tend to go hand in hand. And this has made it very difficult for researchers that have tried to separate these two effects by graft engineering. This is why it's been so difficult. The same cells that cause graft versus host disease tend to be the same cells that cause the graft versus tumor effects.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is actually on graft engineering that you just mentioned. And the question reads, I read you mention graft engineering to improve the graft versus myeloma activity while reducing graft versus host disease in one of your papers. What is actually done in graft engineering?
So this is based on the hypothesis that in fact distinct populations of T cells are responsible for graft versus host disease, and that these are separate and distinct from populations that lead to the graft versus tumor effect. And so, for example, some researchers have separated out T cells that are CD8 positive. CD8 is a protein marker that identifies a particular subset of T cells. And the notion with doing this is that these CD8 T cells are the ones that tend to be more responsible for causing graft versus host disease, but at the same time are not as responsible for the graft versus myeloma effect. And by depleting this distinct population, you can gain for the patient lack of graft versus host disease and still preserve the anti-tumor effect.
Thank you, doctor. The next question is, what is the criteria to choose a suitable candidate to be the donor in allogeneic transplants?
So the most common donor is a brother or sister who is HLA matched. And this is, as I mentioned, this is done by a blood test or even a swab of cells from inside the cheek. This is then tested in the lab to look at HLA typing. And you're looking for a matching between the donor and the patient. If you have a family with full siblings, each sibling has a 25% chance, or 1 out of 4, that they will match with the particular patient. And so if you have 3 siblings and the 4th person is a patient, he has 3 chances, each 25%, that one of those 3 siblings will match with him. Now, once a donor has been identified, they have to pass a health screening as well. So they have to be in good physical condition and not have any major medical problems. They can certainly have some minor things like high blood pressure or other minor health conditions that won't interfere with their ability to donate cells. Once the donor has been identified, the process of donating stem cells is rather simple. It's similar to the way we mobilize stem cells from patients. Donors receive 5 to 7 days of shots with GCSF, which is granulocyte colony stimulating factor. GCSF is a hormone that stimulates white blood cells, mostly neutrophils, in the bone marrow. But it was learned almost 20 years ago that by successive daily administration of GCSF to patients and donors, you could get the stem cells, which normally reside in the bone marrow and don't circulate in the blood, you could get these stem cells to leave the bone marrow and circulate in the bloodstream for a period of several days, and then it's possible to collect those cells. The donor cells are collected on an apheresis machine. This is a blood cell separator. Basically, it's a fancy-looking centrifuge. Sort of looks like a washing machine with a lot of bells and whistles. And the patient donates by venipuncture, or the donor donates by venipuncture, which means a needle is inserted into the veins in the arm on each side. Blood is withdrawn from one side, mixed with a blood thinner so it doesn't clot, and run through the centrifuge where it's fractionated into the liquid and cellular portions. The white blood cell cellular portion is then collected while the rest of the blood is returned to the patient. The donor lies in a bed next to the machine for somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 to 3 hours. There isn't any real pain or discomfort involved other than the discomfort associated with the needle sticks. And at the end of that 2.5 to 3 hours, they often have enough cells to do the transplant. The G-CSF in the donor generally can cause some kind of bone achiness that lasts during the administration. Rarely patients can get headaches or low-grade fevers or nausea, but generally these effects are mild and short-lived and associated just with the time period when they're receiving the shots of G-CSF. But it's pretty simple for the donor to be a donor and not really associated with any serious consequences.
Thank you, Doctor. That was very helpful. We just have a last question. Dr. Benson, how many people have been 100% cured? Ask our listener.
I'm sorry, how many people what?
Have been 100% cured.
Well, I would say that's a difficult question, and I don't know the answer to that. I would say that probably a couple thousand patients worldwide have been cured with donor transplants for myeloma, but that's really a guesstimate based on my view of how many publications have been and the numbers of patients that have been reported in various trials. It's probably a couple of thousand.
Thank you, Doctor. Pat, if the panelists have any more questions, maybe we can just get to them.
What happened to this?
Sure. Gary, do you have a follow-up? Cindy, Jack?
I don't, Pat.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Bensinger. I think we'll bring on our next guest. We have with us a special guest today, Sarah Kaufman-Fink of MMO. Sarah is a multiple myeloma patient who was diagnosed in 2005 at the age of 22. Sarah remains in remission since an autologous stem cell transplant in 2005. She's actively involved in fundraising and raising awareness of multiple myeloma research. Sarah is a board member with the non-profit myeloma organization, MMOR, Multiple Myeloma Opportunities for Research and Education. Now, to recognize the month of March, which is Myeloma Awareness Month, MMOR is conducting an End Myeloma campaign. I invite Sarah to tell us a little bit more about the same. Sarah, you're on air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Sarah. You sound great. How are you doing? How's the new baby?
Good, thank you. I was going to apologize if there's some crying in the background. Hopefully there won't be, but yep, she's 6 weeks old, so we're doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm so excited to talk with all you and a little bit intimidated since you all are such experts. But I wanted to talk a little bit about a crowdfunding campaign that we're doing for some pretty exciting research to commemorate Multiple Myeloma Awareness Month, which is this month, the month of March. And as Priya was saying, I'm not a researcher, I'm a patient, and I'm part of a nonprofit organization called MORE, M-M-O-R-E. It stands for Multiple Myeloma Opportunities for Research and Education, and it's a small grassroots nonprofit that was started in 2008 after I was diagnosed by some of my family and friends, and the goal is to raise funds to support early-stage, innovative, new myeloma treatments with the hopes of bringing us closer to finding a cure for this disease. Since 2008, MORE has donated $2.4 million to myeloma research. We have a scientific advisory board that helps fund. We support, and we've built pretty great relationships with some researchers around the country. And I don't know, I'm sure you all on the panel have realized this too, but it seems like myeloma specialists are a really great group, like a special breed of people. I've yet to meet a myeloma specialist who hasn't just been a wonderful person. So it's been really wonderful to get to know some of them. So what we're doing this month for the Myeloma Awareness Month is we have a what's called a crowdfunding campaign, and that just means an online fundraiser. And we're calling it hashtag EndMyeloma or the EndMyeloma campaign. And the goal of this campaign is to raise $200,000, and that those funds will support a specific research therapy for myeloma research, and that those funds will act as a bridge until the researchers working on this have been granted large sums of money. I think $800,000 grant and working on a $1 million grant. But those funds take time to come in. So this $200,000 is a way for the myeloma community, those of us that are directly affected, to actively participate in making sure that there are no holdbacks, no wasted time, that this research can continue to move forward because it is so promising. And the research is also an immunotherapy option, which maybe people have heard of. It uses CAR T-cell research. CAR stands for chimeric antigen receptor therapy, or CAR T-cell. So just like Dr. Bensinger earlier was saying that the transplant is maybe the oldest form of immunotherapy, this CAR research may very well be the newest form of immunotherapy, the newest promising area of research, at least. So CAR research has been used or has started to be used in the last few years with several different kinds of cancer. There was a research study done at the University of Pennsylvania, I believe, by Dr. June several years ago for acute lymphocytic leukemia, or ALL, and that showed amazing initial results, very, very promising study. And since then, researchers all over the country in all different areas of cancer research have kind of taken this idea and tried to use it with a variety of different cancers. And again, I'm a patient, not a researcher, but I do believe that one of the researchers working on this CAR T-cell research for myeloma will be able to come on Cure Talk next month. So they can talk more specifically about some of the details. But my understanding is that this research or this therapy option would take a patient's cells via a blood draw, separate out their T-cells, the type of immune cell, and genetically modify those cells to specifically target myeloma cells. And of course, that's the difficult part is how do we target them? So that's what the researchers are working on, finding the right markers and to target. And then once those targets have been added to the patient's T-cells, the T-cells are given back to the patient via an infusion, and then those cells are in your body forever. And so those cells ideally will go out and not only kill the myeloma cells, but stay present in your body so that if you were to have a relapse, you know, if the myeloma cells were to begin to proliferate again, then these modified T cells that you already have in your body would jump into action again and be able to tamp down those and attack those myeloma cells before a full-blown remission happened. So this research is currently in laboratory stages. It has been for myeloma. The researchers have been working on it for over a year now, and they have got patents. They've got initial FDA approval. Things seem to be going really swimmingly. But again, for Myeloma Awareness Month, we feel like there's a place for us as the myeloma community, as people who are directly affected and directly impacted by new treatment options. This is a way that we can help participate to help speed up the process of bringing this to patients. So if we're able to get all of our funding in and if everything, you know, if we're able to raise this $200,000, then researchers are confident that the first clinical trials for myeloma using this therapy may be available to patients in as early as 18 months from now, which would be sometime mid to 2016. Which in the scheme of medical research and science innovation is extraordinarily fast. So I'm really excited about this. I think, you know, as many of us patients know, a lot of the current therapy options have a huge amount of side effects. Dr. Bensinger highlighted today some of the side effects associated with an allo transplant, and that's just that's just one treatment option. So if we were able to, if this works as well as we hope it will, then this would have so many fewer side effects. So it would be much easier on a patient's body, and then ideally it would stick around. So relapses would become less of a concern. So I think that's about all I have to say about that. I don't know if there are questions, but I would encourage everyone to go check out our campaign. We have a lot of information online. You can see the campaign at endmyeloma.org, spelled exactly how it sounds. That's our campaign fundraising site. And if you visit MORE's website, which is mmore.org, we have a big link to our End Myeloma campaign, and there's a special link to some more research information on that page as well. So a lot more information about that. And we have some videos. We have a video from one of the researchers, which is on our Facebook page. You can find us at Facebook.com/BeMore. And of course, you can always contact me. And my email address is Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at more.org.
Hey, Sarah, was Dr. Bensinger your doctor when you transplanted?
So I am out here in Seattle, and I do know Dr. Bensinger well. I have a lot of respect for him. So out here at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, when you transplant, you don't stick with one physician. You have they rotate through.
Sure.
So but he was on my transplant team for sure. Mm-hmm. And I was
awesome. Well, the guy has a magic touch. I mean, what's more inspiring than a young woman that responds as well as you did, and now has a baby, a new baby, and it's amazing. It's so great to hear your voice.
You too, Pat. Yep, life is good.
So thank you very much for sharing this information with us, and we will be talking to one of MMO's researchers and talking about the therapy that Sarah just mentioned in our April talk on myeloma. Dr. Bensinger, it was amazing and great listening to you. Thank you very much for having taken time out to be with us and our panel. Pat, Kerry, Jack, and Cynthia, thank you so much for your active participation. Today's talk and transcript will be made available on CureTalks website. Please visit curetalks.com for details on upcoming talks. Till then, thank you so much.
Thank you, Priya. Thank you, Doctor.